BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. And, for rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is the photographer and writer Val Wilmer. She's spent 70 years exploring the music for which she's had a lifelong passion, jazz. She's photographed and interviewed the greats, and when jazz and blues begat rock, she had a ringside seat. Muddy Waters, Duke Ellington, Miles Davis, Jimi Hendrix, Bob Dylan, Aretha Franklin and countless others were all captured in images which have featured in exhibitions in the UK and US since her first major show at the V&A in 1973. She has written seminal music texts, most notably As Serious As Your Life, an exploration of the evolution of so-called free jazz and its racial and gender politics. She took her first portrait when she was a teenager. Borrowing her mother's box brownie, she turned her lens on the jazz pioneer Louis Armstrong at London Airport. He broke into a broad smile and the image became one of her classic shots. She says, "As I get older, I realise how much of what happens in our lives is actually pure luck." Val Wilmer, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
So let's begin with luck, Val, as it is an essential component in every success story. What would you say has been your luckiest shot?
My luckiest shot was the first one, that one of Louis Armstrong at the airport.
How did you know he was going to be there?
My mother and I and my brother, who was very young at the time, we'd all been to see him. And then I read in the paper that he was leaving from what was then called London Airport. It wasn't even called Heathrow. So I said to my mother, could we go? And she hummed and ahed, but it was, I think it was half-term holiday, so she said, all right then. So we went there and suddenly there he was. So we followed him outside and I said, could I have your autograph? And then I said, can I take your picture?
When you were exploring the music side of things, buying records, for example, where did you go? Where did you used to shop?
Well, I was very lucky because I grew up in South London, in Streatham, and there was a place called the Swing Shop. So when I was about 12, I think it was about 12, I walked in there and the guy looks up and he sees this little girl in wearing shorts and he says, yes, what do you want, sort of thing. And he probably thought I wanted a pop record of some kind. But I asked if he had any jazz records. The first one I came to that I recognised the name was Humphrey Lyttelton. Fidgety Feet, the record is called. It was 2 shillings and 6 pence, old money. He said, oh, you can have it for 2 shillings. So I came home with it, and I've still got it tucked away somewhere in a cupboard. My mother said, what's that? She heard this noise. What is that? I said, that's jazz. And that was it, really.
But what was it about jazz that you love? Why did it capture your imagination as a young girl?
Well, it was the excitement, but it's also the story. Because through that record shop, I found out that there were one or two books that told the story of jazz. The first thing you learnt was that jazz comes from Africa. Well, whether jazz comes from Africa is complicated, but of course it does. The force of it, the driving force of it, the whole ethos of it, the whole history is the music of enslaved black people in the Americas creating a new sound as a way of carrying their history.
Well, let's get started. Disc number one.
Well, we're going to hear Louis Armstrong and his Hot 7. They went into the studio one day in 1927 and they recorded Potato Head Blues, which has really never been equaled. Thank you.
Louis Armstrong and his Hot 7, Potato Head Blues. Val Wilmer, let's go back to the beginning then. You're born in 1941 in Harrogate, originally, to Sybil and Eustace, the eldest of two children, but you were brought up in London. What do you remember about your early childhood?
I do remember the air raid shelters, which were still there, and the bomb sites. And we used to play on the bomb sites, especially in the summertime, because they were covered in buddleia and butterflies and so on. But the main thing really, I think, was that my father was very ill, so I have very few memories of him, and he died just before I was seven. So
it was his second marriage, wasn't it?
Yes,
because he was
much
older than your mum.
Yeah, my father was a Victorian. He was born in 1882, and he was a friend of my mother's parents. In fact, he was actually older than my mother's mother, which I always find quite amusing, only by 1 month, but I used to find it very amusing.
As you mentioned, he died when you were very young, the day before your seventh birthday.
That's right, yes, yeah.
Must have been incredibly traumatic for all of you and a huge blow for your mum, who was then left to bring up you and your brother alone.
Yeah, I remember coming home from school and she was polishing the doorstep with, you know, this red polish we used to have, Ronick, and she just had her head down, I suppose, literally, and she said to me when I came home from school, she said, "Darling," she said, "Daddy died today." Just like that, I can still remember her and seeing her say it, you know. Mm-hmm. So life would never be the same as it should have been in the conventional sense, you see.
But I think that she had expected that the family would be looked after in a way that you then weren't, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's
what
right.
Exactly happened?
It's complicated. It's to do with the law of intestacy, and we had a house, but we had nothing else. We had a very nice house, and we had 6 bedrooms. So she took in lodgers, and we used to call, you know, paying guests, which was very common in those days, people who lived with the family and ate their meals with us and so on. But the interesting thing was our first two lodgers was a woman and a man, and the woman was from Ireland and the man was from India. So that's how it started, which is very radical for those days.
So these new influences started coming into the home. Did they bring with them music, stories, you know, a different cultural perspective?
Well, in every way. We had one or two weird people. Only one person ever stole from her. And everybody else was, you know, either okay or else quite a source of wisdom and knowledge. Now, the thing was, because I was 3 years older than my brother, I was the main beneficiary of all this knowledge. He learned a lot, but he didn't learn how to box and fight in the street, which unfortunately is what I learned to do. This is not serious stuff, but it made me a bit of a rough child. But I also learned how to use tools because for my 10th birthday, one of the lodgers gave me a rabbit. And so one of the others said, "Well, we've got to have a proper hutch." So we made a hutch, was like 3 times the size of those little things you see.
Well, those woodworking skills are going to come in very handy on the island.
They are,
Val.
Yes.
For now, I think we'll have your second piece of music, if you wouldn't mind. What's it going to be and why?
Well, we're going to listen to Big Bill Brinsey, an extremely influential guitar player. I saw him in 1957 when I was about 15, at the Royal Festival Hall of all places. This is a song that when you're that age, and especially when you grow up just as a wave of migration from the Caribbean, and you see black people in the streets and on the buses and sweeping the streets, and you say, "Who are those people?" And you're told, "Don't talk about them." And then you hear this song. I think it might awaken you up a little bit. This is Black, Brown and White.
This little song that I'm singing about people you know is true. If you black and gotta work for a living, this is what they will say to you. This is, if you's white, she's all right. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, brother, get back, get back, get
Big
back.
Bill Brunsey and Black, Brown and White. So Val, it sounds like the dynamics at home were changing a lot. And along with the lodgers, Val, the paying guests, there were two other important influences on your early life, the church and the girl guides. I can imagine you enjoying woodwork and tying knots.
Well, you see, the thing is, people who go to the girl guides, break down into two types. There's the little girls who are sort of always girly, and there's the others who want to get out and be hikers, pioneers and bushwomen. And I was one of those. It was exciting to me. And I still think, I was thinking about it only this morning coming here, if you ever ask people what's the happiest you've ever been. And to me, it was going off to camp, sitting round the campfire at night, eating sausages that you've cooked yourself and singing campfire songs together.
I mean, this sounds like you're going to get on a treat on the desert island. And what about Girl Guides, Val? Did you collect your badges keenly?
I did, yes. But also in the Girl Guides, I became a cub instructor. I went to our local church, was a very, very ancient church. And I told my mother one day, I told her, I don't believe in God anymore. I'm not coming to church anymore. She was very upset. But I had to go to the church parade still with the wolf cubs. The reason I liked going there was I liked the sound of the organ when they played hymns like Eternal Father, Strong to Save. The whole church, the wood reverberated with the organ.
So the feeling of that, being in the middle of the music physically,
absolutely,
feeling it and being surrounded by it, was powerful from the beginning for
me. Very
you.
Powerful. And whenever I could get on stage, I did. And at one time, I was with the Duke Ellington Orchestra in the Albert Hall, in the middle of the Duke Ellington Orchestra and the London Philharmonic Orchestra, all at the same time, taking photos at rehearsal. But the sound all around you is quite something else.
Val, it's time for your third disc. What have you gone for?
Well, we're going to hear something completely different. When I left school, I went to study photography. It wasn't really my intention, but I got a job in a darkroom. I used to go in the darkroom every day. I think it was at about 10:45 or something on the home service, probably. I can't remember. There was a classical record. And I walked in there one day and I just automatically switched the radio on. And I heard this amazing sound and I didn't know what it was. It's Kodály's Sonata for Unaccompanied Cello.
Part of the first movement of Kodály's Sonata for Solo Cello, played by Janos Starka. Val Wilmer, when you left school after taking A-levels, what were your plans?
When I was at Streatham High, we had, with two other girls, we had a school magazine. I think it only lasted one issue. So I thought perhaps I'd like to be a journalist, but I didn't get much encouragement from the careers department. You know, this is a time when women were so... Their lives were so circumscribed. You know, life was so limited. Mm. Every time you turn round, you were told women don't do that or ladies don't that. Ladies don't go into pubs. Can you imagine that? I had started doing a bit of photography, like of the sort of scout troop and things like that. Next thing I know, I'm studying photography at Regent Street Polytechnic.
And pursuing your passion for music, you photographed and got to know many leading musicians. Some of them spent time at your home and actually met your mum. Did she appreciate the calibre of artists that were coming through her front door?
I think she did, gradually, yes. She met Duke Ellington a couple of times because I was friendly with Harry Carney, who was his right-hand man, the baritone player of the band. Well, obviously, she knew how important he was. And we went to Berlin together. I was taking some photographs for Melody Maker at the Berlin Jazz Festival. And unfortunately, on the opening night, there was a lot of alcohol flowed freely. I got fairly inebriated and she got really drunk for the first and only time in her life. And I had to pick up the pieces. And next day, she was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and I felt I wanted to die. I just absolutely wanted to die. And for her sake, I struggled through the day knowing that I had to take photographs that night. And I did. And then I said, well, of course, they're having a party for Duke Ellington's, I think it was his 73rd birthday. She's so good, you know. And I said, we're not going. And she was so upset and so disappointed. And I had to go to this bloody party. And I walked around with a tray in front of me with about four glasses of orange juice on it. I wanted to die. And my mother, and then Harry said, oh, Duke said, have you seen Mrs. Wilmer? And he said, no, how are you doing? How are you doing? And, you know, two kisses on either cheek.
Just amazing. So you spent a year studying photography, Val, and then you got a job working in the office of the magazine Tropic. What was your role?
I wrote a couple of articles for them, and then they asked me if I'd like to go and work for them, and went to work in this shabby office off Edgware Road with a bullet hole in the window.
Why did it have a bullet hole?
It had a bullet hole in the window because the descendants of Oswald Mosley had shot it up one night. My job was to be a receptionist, but what it did, it was the most extraordinary thing that could ever happen to somebody, a young person like me. I suddenly was plunged into an all-black world 5 days a week, and we acted as a sort of a meeting place for people, so that writers, politicians, African musicians, Caribbean musicians, anybody who was anybody came through that door.
Val, let's have your next piece of music now. It's your fourth choice today. What have you gone for and why are you taking this to the island?
After I worked for Tropic, I was working in a darkroom in Soho. And I used to wander around Soho and I was fascinated by the front of house photography. And one of them was a famous play called A Raisin in the Sun, which is by Lorraine Hansberry. She was the first African-American woman to have a play on Broadway. And this poem by Langston Hughes, What Happens to a Dream Deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? Which is what the play was named for. Amongst all the many musician friends I'd made was a man that I became quite closely involved with, a bass player called Art Davis. I said to him, when you go back to New York, can you get me a book of Langston Hughes's poetry? So he got it for me, and I fell in love with Langston Hughes in the May of 1962. I was going to New York. Before leaving, I wrote to Langston Hughes and I said, can I come and photograph you? And he wrote back and said, sure, call me when you get there. Langston Hughes could not have been more wonderfully warm and welcoming. We drank scotch on the rocks out of extremely large glasses. At the end of my meeting with Langston, we went down to the front of the building to take some photographs. There were some little boys that lived next door, and so I photographed him with them. And when I got back to London, I sent him a few copies of the photographs, and he sent me another collection of his poetry. This is The Weary Blues from a book of the same name.
Prone in a drowsy, syncopated tune, rocking back and forth to a mellow croon, I heard a Negro play. Down on Lenox Avenue the other night, by the pale, dull pallor of a one-bulb light, he did a lazy sway. He did a lazy sway to the tune of those weary blues. With his ebony hands on each ivory key, he made that poor piano moan with melody. Oh, blues. Swaying to and fro on his rickety stool, he played that sad, raggy tune like a musical fool. Sweet blues. Coming from a black man's soul. Oh, blues.
Langston Hughes reading The Weary Blues, accompanied by Red Allen's band. Val, I want to take you back to 1964. By that time, you were working for a London-based magazine called Flamingo, and they gave you an assignment to travel to West Africa for 6 weeks to collect stories and photos for the magazine. You've said this trip was a huge influence on you. It must have been quite an adventure. What do you remember about it when you think back?
Well, I went to four countries. Gambia, which was a little tiny place. No such thing was tourism there then. Sierra Leone, which of course historically is a very significant place in African history. Liberia, and northern Nigeria. So they're all the places that people didn't go to in any sort of travelling sense very often. I did all sorts of things I had to do. I did stories on marriage at 14, good or bad, iron ore production, and music. And I think one of the things that influenced me most, funnily enough, I grew up in a world where you had a trade or a profession, but there people didn't seem to do that. So you'd meet a man and he's got an office, but then you find out he's also an estate agent, and then you find out he runs a taxi service, and then you find out he also runs a small aeroplane. And then people would tell me, you see those women in the market, they went there with pennies, they made enough money to put their sons through college. And it was true, there had been people who had bought a couple of pig's feet, take them home, cook them, sell them in the market. And the next day they buy four pig's feet. Next day they buy a dozen. And they end up being able to educate their children and not only that, send them to university overseas. I had never dreamed such a thing was possible. I'd been brought up to think that we were in advance of the third world, as it was known in those days, you know, that we were so progressive. And I found out we weren't. We weren't progressive at all. We were just different.
Val, it's time for your fifth disc, if you wouldn't mind. What have you chosen?
In Freetown in Sierra Leone, I met a man called S.E. Rogers, known as Rogie. And he put out a record on his own record label. It's a song about his best friend stealing his girlfriend away. It's a very sad song. It's a very beautiful song. And it was one of the most popular records of that age in West Africa. And it shows the influence of singers like Jim Reeves, which people are not expecting to hear in West Africa.
There's quite a big country and western scene out there.
Exactly, yes. So here we can hear Rogie now singing My Lovely Elizabeth.
My Lovely Elizabeth.
I am deeply worried at heart. I say I'm deeply worried at heart. 'Cause the girl I love so well, my friend has snatched from me. Now I scarcely know what to do.
S.E. Rogers and My Lovely Elizabeth. You travelled all over the US during the 60s and into the 70s, Val, listening to jazz, recording interviews with artists, and that time was pivotal for the civil rights movement. Were you conscious of a need to chronicle what was happening in your music writing?
I wanted to go to the South and hear people singing the blues in the rural situation, and I wanted to go to churches and I wanted to go to New Orleans. But because of slavery and the whole history, the South was not a jolly place to be. I met a lot of people who've envied me my experiences, but there was a price to be paid. You needed to be eternally vigilant yourself, and also to meet a lot of people who were not necessarily that happy to meet you. Mm. Their lives have been so blighted by racism, it could be quite overwhelming. So I learnt what an innocent in the world I was, even at the age of 31 or whatever it was. Mm. Well, you see what's happening in the world today and what's happening in the United States today. It hasn't gone away. Racism is still a fact of everyday life. And W.E.B. Du Bois said it at the beginning of the 20th century. He said the problem of the 20th century is the colour line. He said that in The Souls of Black Folk. And it really hasn't changed. I mean, obviously it's improved in many ways. People aren't being lynched every day and so on, but it's not a happy place to be in. You know, we all grew up thinking that, you know, names can never hurt me, but it's not true. Words can hurt people. They hurt people for the whole of their lives. They hurt people for centuries.
Val, some of your books are regarded as classics, Jazz People and As Serious As Your Life. And whilst many people were happy to be interviewed, not all musicians were compliant. I know that Miles Davis was tricky and Thelonious Monk was quite hard to pin down. How did you succeed in the end?
Well, Monk is not a very articulate person. He's a person who goes a week without speaking. I had a friend, John Hopkins, who was a photographer, Hoppy said, listen, man, he said, we should, Monk's coming to town, we should go and interview him and we'll sell the story to Playboy. We went to a rehearsal that he was doing for a BBC television programme. I went up to him and said, excuse me, Mr. Monk, could we come and interview you? He said, yeah, come tomorrow afternoon at 4, whatever it was. I said, okay, so Hoppy and I got together, we met, they were staying at the Hilton, and Monk was just about to have some sandwiches. He's had sent down to room service, and so he was very monosyllabic, you know, everything was, yeah, meh. After a while, we started to ask him questions, got him slightly riled, and Hoppy asked him something, I think, that was quite political, and he got really mad, and he shouted at us, and he got up, and he paced up and down, and he started to speak. And it made quite a sensation amongst the musicians because nobody ever heard him talk that much before.
And that brings us to disc number 6.
We're going to have Criss Cross by Thelonious Monk. This is a record I learned to dance to with a Nigerian boyfriend of mine. They said we couldn't dance this kind of music, but he showed me how.
How do you get it right? What's the key?
Just go for it.
Thelonious Monk and Criss Cross. Val, in the late 70s, you broadened your horizons. You became involved in the feminist movement and worked with Spare Rib magazine and numerous other collectives at the leading edge of what was becoming that new wave of feminism. What did it feel like to be part of that?
The thing is that people of my, born about the time that I was born, those of us who had survived, despite all the rigours of the female existence, when we heard about this new wave feminism coming along, the truth is it probably was slightly daunting. We reckoned that we'd done pretty well without it, but gradually the siren cry of the women's movement became too strong. People were organising about many things that would improve women's lot, and it was very, very attractive. All sorts of things, like trade union magazines and news magazines were changing. And we helped to change them in their coverage. And eventually, together with Maggie Murray, who's someone I've been at college with, we started an agency called Format Women Photographers.
And that was the first of its kind. There hadn't been an all-female photographic
then,
agency.
No,
so this is 1983.
Yeah.
There was a focus right from the beginning, I think, with changing the ideas of representation in the industry. How did that work, and what did the agency achieve?
We like to change people's minds about things. So if they asked for a photograph of somebody in a particular trade or occupation, they'd expect a photograph of a man.
So this is a newspaper getting in touch saying, we need such and such a photo of a banker or a builder or whatever.
We send a woman banker. And at the same time, when they expected that we'd send a picture of a white person, we'd send a picture of someone of colour doing the same job.
Your photography skills were called on, you know, as someone represented by the agency when you would go on demos. I mean, Reclaim the Night marches. Mm-hmm. You were often shooting what was happening and doing that kind of reportage photography. Was it ever dangerous work?
I got punched by a policeman once. He didn't realise I was a woman. The worst thing that happened was on the 1977 march of the National Front through Lewisham, protected by the police, and I was taking pictures and I got hit over the head by a dustbin lid by the someone in the SWP who came and apologised for throwing it. But if anybody asks you what it's like seeing stars, I can testify, yes, you do.
Val, I think we better have some more music. Your seventh choice, what have you gone for and why?
Well, I spent a lot of the 70s and 80s listening to a lot of free jazz, and that's when I wrote my book, As Serious As Your Life. This is a sort of typical thing. Julius Hemphill, alto sax player, Abdul Wadud on cello, and they've named it after famous people of the Malian cliffs, cliff-dwelling people, the Dogon, and they've called it Dogon AD.
Julius Hemphill Trio, Dogon AD. Val Wilmer, so many of the photos that you've taken over the years have become definitive. You know, they've actually gone on to shape how we think about the artists that you were capturing and their aesthetic, you know, their attitude. John Coltrane, Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong. Did you have any idea at the time that those moments were special?
Well, you do sometimes. Yes, definitely. It's like anything in any creative field, the harder you try, the more obvious it'll be. And some of my favourite photographs are ones I took fairly early on, so I wasn't trying to make sure that I got everything right. So I photographed a pianist called Freddie Redd, an American pianist, and it was only years later I was looking at the negatives and I realised I'd never printed these particular negatives. So I started to print this neg, and it was just a simple picture of him sitting with a cigarette by the dressing room mirror. But everything was right about it, the quality, the sort of feeling of it, where those photographs where you feel you can reach in and touch the person.
Oh, yeah.
But I've got this picture of Freddie Redd. I've got it framed, a very nice frame in the hall. And every time I walk by, I think, hello, Freddie, how's it going? But really, I'm saying, hello, Val, how's it going?
Well, yeah, that's it. Val, you know, people often, when they're talking about you, they often remark on how lightly you wear your achievements and your status. And I wonder about that. And I wonder whether that's an intrinsic part of you or whether that's an attitude that's developed over years of hanging out with musicians who just, you know, play it cool.
Well, not all musicians play it cool. Some are arrogant, as we know. Well, I was a shy person. I still am. Well, you know, it's ridiculous to be this age and to call yourself shy. You have to be able to handle yourself in the world. But I was shy, and I think that was part of it, really. And to be sensitive, you know, to others. And it all goes back to all those days in the church and the Girl Guides and like, discovering jazz and going to Africa. That's where it all starts, how you form yourself. And you see arrogant people, like people who play their own records all the time. You think, oh, I don't want to be like that. I don't spend all my time looking at my photographs. And Duke Ellington, somebody said to him, what's your favourite tune? He looked at them like, yeah, he said, oh, he said, the next one. He said, the new baby is always the favourite. And I think there's a lot in that.
It's almost time to cast you away, Val. What will you miss the most, do you think?
People. I have to see people nearly every day, although I do spend a lot of time on my own. I live on my own. But if I don't see people every day, I feel strange.
What about survival skills? We heard about your woodworking and your boxing. Right, sounds like you can handle yourself.
I don't know about boxing. I'm not there. It's going to get me very far, but
there's a resilience there. There's
yes,
a kind
I think
of,
so. Well,
you know.
Yes.
All right. Well, we'll let you have one more disc before we send you to your desert island, Val Wilmer. What's your last choice going to be?
Well, it probably will surprise some people who think of me as an old jazzer, but this is a record that sums up being in the women's movement for me. It was the record that everybody played. Just in the jazz world, everybody had Miles's Kind of Blue. They had this one. And it somehow reminds me of myself. And it's Joan Armatrading, Love and Affection.
Really move, really move. Now if I can feel the sun in my eyes and the rain on my face, why can't I feel love? Really love, really love, really love, really love, really love.
Joan Armatrading, Love and Affection. So, Val Wilmer, the time has come. I'm casting you away to the island with, as you know, three books, the Bible, the complete works of Shakespeare, and a book of your choice. What would you like?
Can I take Langston Hughes with me, his collected poetry?
Oh, absolutely. Did he sign it before he sent it to you?
Yes, he did.
What did Langston Hughes write in your book?
In one of the books he gave me, he wrote, "Inscribed especially for Valerie Wilmer, with a hearty welcome to our USA, Langston Hughes, NYC, May the 1st, 1962.
It's yours. You can also have a luxury item, something that will make your time on the island more enjoyable. What would you like?
I'm afraid it breaks the rules of useful things, but it's very, very small.
Talk me
nail through. Scissors.
Oh, right.
Which have a lot of uses, but I won't tell you what they are.
Okay. Well, I mean, we've allowed these personal grooming items previously because there's a sort of aesthetic impetus there that isn't strictly practical. And finally, this is the most difficult question for you, I think, Val. Which of these 8 discs would you rush to save from the waves?
This is terrible, but I think I'll take The Monk with me.
Thelonious Monk, Chris Cross.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. Just sums up the kind of music that I like. And Monk is just one of my all-time favourites.
Perfect. Val Wilmer, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you very much, Lauren.
Hello, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Val. I don't dare ask what she's getting up to on the island with those nail scissors, though. There are many more castaways in the Desert Island Discs archive, including photographers Eve Arnold, Vanley Burke and Martin Parr, as well as jazz artists like the very man Val snapped at the airport all those years ago, Louis Armstrong himself. Search for Desert Island Discs on BBC Sounds. The studio manager for today's programme was Jackie Marjoram. The assistant producer was Christine Pavlovsky, and the producers were Sarah Taylor and Tim Bano. The series editor is John Gowdy. Next time, my guest will be the actor Cillian Murphy. Do join me then.
The Post Office Horizon scandal has shocked Britain.
Post Office IT scandal, which has had so much publicity, hasn't it, over the last...
This is a scandal of historic proportions.
I've been following the story for more than a decade, hearing about the suffering of sub-postmasters like Joe Hamilton and Alan Bates.
It was just horrendous. The whole thing was horrendous.
I was told you can't afford to take on Post Office.
And about their extraordinary fight for justice. What was motivating you?
Well, it was wrong what they did.
Listen to the true story firsthand from the people who lived it in the Great Post Office Trial from BBC Radio 4 with me, Nick Wallace. Subscribe on BBC Sounds.